It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 229, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, mediocre rumors, AI bubble, amazing cameras, and more.
Hi, Gary. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. You know, summer's over. It is.
It over? Oh, okay.
Over. Yes.
It's like 92 today. It seems like
still. Oh, no. Seattle's ahead of the game then, because it's been rainy, it's been wet, it's been windy, it's been cold. I mean, I had to break out my raincoat, all that kind of stuff. It's just so, oh well.
Yeah, we still got at least two wildfires left before the summer's over, I think.
Well, I hope nobody gets hurt. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
So, we got stuff to talk about. Specifically have an event.
Yeah, Apple's got its fall event. Apple usually had two events in the fall. The one that gets the most attention is the new iPhone event. It's been fairly consistent now that September they announced the new iPhone models. Mm-hmm. The iPhone 16 will be coming on September 9th. That's when they're going to announce. So you could probably count on like end of that week will be when it's, maybe some of the models are available, and the end of next week, maybe others. And they'll probably announce iOS 18 and iPadOS 18 release dates. Then sometimes they announce macOS new release dates. So we don't know if that's going to be like, in 2 weeks, or the macOS one could be all the way in October for all we know. So we don't really know what's coming, but the rumors are it's pretty mediocre in terms of like what's rumored. Like pretty much everybody agrees it's just going to be the new iPhone lineup,
mm-hmm.
new iPads, or maybe a new iPad mini. That's about it. And then a new Apple Watch and new AirPods, maybe. So a lot of updates to existing products. Of course, when iOS 18 comes out, or to be more correct, iOS 18.1, so probably a month or so after iOS 18, that's when all the Apple Intelligence stuff hits. So it's going to be a long fall because there's going to be, iOS 18 with new features and then 18.1 with all the, AI features. A lot of that stuff going on. There's really not too much talked about in terms of like, if these are hardware-wise are going to be a big departure from anything we had before. There have been some rumors that there's going to be a slimmer iPhone, not that the iPhones aren't already super thin. And of course, the big thing is that, all of these new products now are going to be capable of using Apple Intelligence. So it'll be about like the processors, here is the new, A18 processor or whatever that's going to be in them. So they can use all the new stuff. So yeah, got that to look forward to. I don't expect any surprises for anything, and probably another event later in October or early November where we might get some new Mac models, which might be more interesting because there's like a rumored, mini.
Right, we talked about that last week. Yeah.
So that could be something there, and also updating, say, the MacBook Pros and the iMac with new processors and stuff like that. So yeah, it's the summer. Well, as you said, the summer is ending. So this is what happens at the end of the summer of the Apple world. Is there's like the release of new stuff. I always know the summer is getting close to an end because I start having to record my annual course that uses the latest Mac OS. Course. So doing that for macOS Sequoia now, just doing a few videos a day when I can. Which before I did that course, I was always updating my iPad book, which ran from like 2010 to 2018.
Right.
And fall would always be when I'd be like, well, I'm working on, on the documents now and updating the iPad course.
I remember
so always some, August.
Conferences that you and I went to where all of a sudden you were busy at the back of the room working on your iPad book because it just got released.
Oh, I hate it. And just from doing, from doing this stuff, I mean, I do more, Apple's got this release schedule annual release schedule for so many things, and I'm always doing videos that like are very up to date, trying to be like, here's something new and here's
Right.
how to use it. And Apple will have things that I just know about way in advance, like the in the betas of new Mac OS. But then they have things that they just don't do betas for, like they may drop a new version of Pages, no warning, no rumors, nobody had any idea, and it's got like some new feature in it, and it's like literally, I'll release a video at 9 in the morning, and at 9:30 I'll see a new story, new version of Pages comes out that allows you to do whatever, and I'll be like, oh, all right, there go my plans for the rest of the day because I got to get that, figure it out, and then do a video for the next morning, which is not how I like to do things. I know you like to be ahead of schedule by a bit. I
That's
like to be
correct.
ahead of schedule by a bit. I like to be able to think that I could maybe walk away from my desk and do something else. Like I went camping last week. What if Apple had to release a new version of Numbers on Wednesday? I wouldn't even have known until Friday night, And that always puts me a little bit on edge. And I enjoy new stuff. I enjoy doing videos on the new stuff, but sometimes it's so inconvenient. I remember once Apple announced some new stuff right in the middle of like I was going to Hawaii for like 5 days. It was just supposed to be just a relaxing like 5 day getaway, and then Apple was like, oh, the second day of that, forget your vacation because we're doing a big announcement on the second day, and I had to spend like all morning just dealing with that.
It's so you're better about it than I am for sure, because I don't even try. There's a lot of cases where I will throw out a video on something, or even an article on something, a feature of Windows. And if it's common between the two, if they, the look may change, because when I mean, one of the big differences between 10 and 11, for example, is that, the windows have a slightly different look. They've got different corners. They're rounded and square versus square, and the colors are different and that kind of stuff. I won't do a whole new video just because of that. I will, there are definitely, it gets kind of fuzzy, because even if things aren't exactly the same, if they're close enough that I think that most people can, intuit what the right thing to do for their version of Windows is, I'll usually let it sit and focus on the other stuff. If it's something big, then of course, yeah, that requires some more focus. But, yeah, I no, I want to be at least 2 or 3 weeks ahead, and I'm not going to let Microsoft make me jump.
No, and I appreciate that. And I think the Windows world is a little bit more casual when it comes to that because of Microsoft's release schedule. And certainly the Mac world, there's a part of it that people are just as casual about it. People that will actually ask me a question months after a new version of Mac OS comes out, and it's apparent they're still in the old version. And I say, oh, that changed to the new version. You haven't updated yet. Oh, I didn't realize the new version came out. Very casual like that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, But other people that are already asking me questions, they're like, I'm on the beta of macOS Sequoia. I'm trying to do this. Do you know how to use it? I'm like, oh, you're already asking me questions about it. It's just the beta. So
And
yeah,
you're also facing something that I suspect you're facing. I know that it's something that I have to face. That is simply that, with the hardware requirements changing between Windows 10 and 11, right? There's a higher bar. Your machine has to, be X, Y, and Z in order to run Windows 11. A lot of people are either being, forced to, if you will, or electing to stick with Windows 10, which means that even though Windows 10 reaches end of support at the end of next year, let's see, a year from October, there will continue to be Windows 10 questions for some time to come, regardless of what happens on Windows 11, because it's not pragmatic for some people to actually upgrade the OS. So yeah, it's, we're supporting multiple versions at the same time. I assume that the same kind of sort of thing is happening with you, with, the M1 or the M series of processors, but I suspect we're now also a little bit further along in that too.
Well, it's going to be interesting because typically Apple supports things like some new feature on machines that have been announced, say, the last 3 or 4 years. And then in general, the operating system that they come out with is goes back 6 or 7 years for support. There might be a few things like little asterisks saying this feature only available on these models, that kind of thing. But in general, it's that. But with Apple Intelligence, it's much tighter. Like for instance, on the iPhone, only the iPhone 15 Pro models, two models of the current generation, can use Apple Intelligence. So if you have the current regular iPhone 15, some of the stuff's not supported on it. And like you don't even have a new model you can buy now, like unless you want to go to the 15 Pro from the 15, which is kind of ridiculous to do. So that's pretty like they're going to come out with the stuff. And if you're a non-pro iPhone user, you have to get a new iPhone if you want to use that new feature. That's like it's going to be a very different kind of thing. Max, it's a little bit better because it, you know, anything that has the M processors, they've been putting those out for a few years. And iPads, it's a mixed bag because some of the pro iPads have had those for a couple of years. So it's going to be interesting. There's going to be a lot of videos I'm going to be doing this fall on Apple Intelligence when they actually release it, that it's going to be, you know, people that can see my video but can't use it, even though they can't be blamed for being out of date because they just bought, like, oh, I bought an iPhone 8 months ago and I can't use this, you know? So, yeah, that's going to be a little different, but.
It's funny now that I think about it, though, because I think that the Windows folks are going to be in a very similar position. Microsoft has this new Copilot thing. There's now this concept of a Copilot PC, which very similar to what you're describing. These are PCs that have some AI hardware included. And they're the only ones, for example, that are going to be able to run that feature that has gotten some controversial feedback about taking screenshots every 5 seconds, or remembering what you're doing and that kind of stuff. But again, it's that you just happen to buy a PC that has the AI hardware. Great, you get that feature and it gets to work. If you don't have it, you don't.
And that kind of leads me to like another subject. The whole, you know, we've been talking nonstop about AI for, you know, a year and a half or whatever.
This is true.
And although strangely, we talked about AI in the very first episode of the Tech Enthusiast Hour podcast. But
Go
yeah,
look at
so
my records here.
it was just different. But yeah, so the thing is that, you know, what I hear a lot from, especially from non-tech people, is the mention that, oh, AI is just another bubble. And a bubble meaning that something that's really hyped up seems to be the future. And then it kind of, the bubble bursts and it's not that, it turns out it's not that big of a deal. Like a good example of the most recent bubble was NFTs, right? These, especially in terms of like people putting artwork and saying, here's some NFTs and you can buy it and you don't own it and you don't own the copyright, but you know, it's this whole thing.
You
And
own
it's
some
like,
bits,
oh,
yes.
you made a, somebody made $1 million, like a kid made $1 million yesterday selling NFTs of their graffiti or whatever. But, and that was like a bubble that burst. And you know, most of those NFTs are worthless now. The thing is that AI is definitely not one of those. And you know, first of all, you've got all of the companies doing things like Microsoft and Apple and Google coming out with new products, not that aren't AI itself, which I think is important. They're products built on top of it. So there, that's kind of interesting. The other thing about it is that, like, I have already been using AI now for the first like use case that came out was coding, right? It was the very first thing. It was like the first examples. Look how you can use this for coding. And I've been using it for coding now for more than a year. I'm never going back. Like there is no way that I could ever go back to coding without AI now. It's like you want me to go back to Stack Overflow and ask questions there or try to look stuff up? No. No way. I'm not saying it is coding for me. It's just a tool I use. I can't go back. It'd be like somebody who's a roofer going back to saying, ah, nail guns. We don't need those anymore. We'll just go back to hammer and nails. No, nail guns like kind of like are a tool that's required when you're putting up a new roof. AI is kind of like that for coding now. Even if it's just as your assistant, which is basically what it is, it's
Right.
your little buddy assistant helping you code.
You still
It's
got to
so
check his work.
valuable. Yeah, I there's no going back. So AI is not the kind of bubble that can burst and it just goes away. And like 5 years from now, we're like, remember AI? Whatever happened to that? AI may be doing things right now that it doesn't end up being a real part of
Right.
eventually. And it's also going to end up doing things that we haven't even started to use it for.
Correct. Yeah.
But it's definitely not a bubble. It's here to stay. It's here to stay summarizing our stuff, predicting what we're going to type, helping us as an assistant, whether you're a writer or a coder or trying to come up with numbers or business plans or whatever it is. I was even talking to people the other day about, how important it is in job searches, from everything from like helping you with your resume to putting together like proposals for work and all sorts of stuff like that. It's just become this invaluable tool, and even for companies to be able to go through all the job applications.
I just find it interesting that, in my case, AI in certain realms is significantly more creative than I am, which sounds really weird because AI isn't really creative. It's, much more ponderous than that. Somebody said it's a glorified text prediction term or tool. But, especially when it comes to images, it's allowing me to do things and find things that honestly I just wouldn't do without it. And it's fascinating. I think a lot of what we'll see AI turning into has a lot to do with individual people's strengths and weaknesses. I'm using it to fill in for some of my weaknesses, i.e. creativity, particularly when it comes to images. In some cases, it's a time-saving tool, like you're seeing with coding. But in other cases, I think it's allowing people to do things that they otherwise normally wouldn't do, assuming that, they're willing to give it a try. So yeah, and you're right. I do think that, 5 years from now, hell, 2 years from now, we're going to be using things, using AI for things we didn't think of today. And some of what we might consider common use cases today will have fallen by the wayside.
Indeed. Anyway, I thought that was I just wanted to touch on that because that's what's coming up with all this Apple stuff.
Yeah, and it's interesting in one way because, I almost feel guilty that we talk about AI so often. But on the other hand, it's part of what's happening right now. It's changing the landscape. It's honestly, I find it incredibly exciting technology. It does put the, enthusiast in the tech enthusiast hour. And it's just fascinating to watch it grow and change and see the different use cases come up. And along with that, some of the conundrums that are coming up, both technological and ethical. I mean, the whole, copyright discussion is a very, very important discussion to have. We've talked about it before. That, is sucking up somebody's copyrighted work and quote unquote learning from it. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Is there compensation required? All that kind of stuff. And I don't have answers for that kind of stuff, but I do think it'll be very, very interesting to watch those kind of discussions happen and see what kind of resolutions those issues come to. But yeah, yep, interesting stuff.
Yeah,
Like you say, it's not going to be a bubble.
I saw a funny TikTok just earlier today. One of the common things coders do is we like to think of the optimal way to do things, like the optimal way to sort a list of
Yes.
numbers or text. But sometimes we'd like to think of ridiculous things, like the most ridiculous way to sort a list, right? And come up with algorithms that are completely nonsensical but may work
Right.
in some way. And there were some funny ones there. Like, for instance, there was one just called, I think I've seen this before, random sort, where you randomize the list. You check to see if it happens to be in alphabetical order now that you've randomized it. And if it is, you're done. If not, loop. That's an example of like a ridiculous way to sort a list. But
Going to
another.
be order n factorial, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And, but, they added to this list one I hadn't seen before, every time I've seen people talk about this, and that was a call to ChatGPT. Here's a list, please sort this for me.
There you go.
Like a little just a function call ChatGPT through an API to be like, hey, and this works great. So
Oh, that is hilarious.
So speaking of hilarious, so what is this story here you put about? I think I saw this in the news.
Right.
about
So,
the it's like he's like the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia or something. I saw him
I don't
referred
think
to.
he's that, but he is the Pavel Durov is who we're talking about. He is the, I don't know if he's the CEO or just the guy behind the instant messaging platform Telegram.
Telegram, sure.
And earlier this week, he was arrested by French authorities because he happened to land on French soil, in his private jet, no less, which I thought was kind of interesting. But nonetheless, he's been arrested, and it's all part of apparently an ongoing investigation into how Telegram is being used for illegal purposes. Now, I find it interesting because Telegram is, of course, nothing more than a communications mechanism. It's encrypted, right? That's one of the reasons that it gets used for questionable activity is that it is end-to-end encrypted. And Telegram, the company, I don't know that it's Mr. Durov personally, but Telegram, the company, is either unable or unwilling to expose or hand over unencrypted conversations or other information about what's actually happening on their platform. Hence the arrest, because law enforcement desperately wants that kind of information to be able to squash whatever these illegal activities happen to be. I kind of see it as arresting the manufacturers of paper if people end up using letters for this same kind of purpose, right? It's a tool and it can be used in some interesting ways. Many are important. And I think that's ultimately why I wanted to bring this up because, yeah, it's interesting that he got arrested. And hopefully, I think, unless they actually charge him with something, they have to release him in the next day or two. And of course, by then, I'm sure he'll have plenty to say about it on his Telegram channel, no doubt. But it really exposes or highlights, I guess, an issue that we've been dealing with for a long time. And I think we're going to be dealing with for a much longer time as technologies get more and more sophisticated. The concept is simply this. If you've got a tool that can do something like hide your conversation from anybody outside, point-to-point encrypted, pure privacy, that's being used for something illicit. What are the rules? How does one determine that it's being used for something illicit like that? One way is to look at the contents of the message, but that breaks the fundamental privacy slash encryption, quote unquote, guarantee that the tool is attempting to provide. And it also kind of squashes the whole concept of free speech, for lack of a better term, although I hate that phrase, on that platform, because it then also ends up putting a damper on what you and I might consider to be very legitimate and very important privacy-oriented conversations on that platform. The scenarios that I tend to talk about when I talk about this kind of stuff are whistleblowers or dissidents or news media who are embedded in hostile situations who need to get out important information that the local government, for example, would not want to see released. How much control should a local government have? The government would tell you that, of course, they need full control. They want to be able to see all messages just in case there's something bad going on. My take on it, of course, is that no, privacy is actually more important than that. The ability to have an inherently private communication from point A to point B is actually more important than that kind of stuff. Now, the reason it's controversial at all is what I call, quote unquote, that kind of stuff can be pretty heinous. Right. I mean, they are talking about child sexual stuff, right? Illicit materials in that regard. I think a lot of people tend to jump to things like drug trafficking and that kind of stuff, which is bad enough. But I think that a lot of people would probably agree that pornography involving children or any of those other kinds of things would probably be worse on the scale of heinousness if there is such a thing. And that's actually, I get that that is something that by preserving privacy, we're enabling that kind of stuff, or at least allowing it to happen via those channels. I don't know. It's a tough issue. It really is. I want to see privacy because I think it is very important, and I want to see it worldwide, even though Telegram, for example, is banned in a certain number of countries. Although, once again, that's a technological problem that often has technological solutions, and people can start using it anyway. I don't know. What do you think? Have you put some thought into this whole,
privacy? I don't get why governments sometimes, try to make the argument that, like, oh, your platform's being used for illegal things, therefore we need to go after you, when you're just enabling, encryption or whatever. And I wonder if sometimes it's done as a deterrent, with the idea being like, okay, so we know a bunch of criminals are using Telegram to do this stuff. If we arrest this guy, put him in jail for 2 days where he can't talk or whatever, just basically tell him, look, we're going to let you go, just, and we're going to say some stuff about, like, how we want a back door, and then you're going to say you refuse to give us the back door, and we'll leave it at that. But it's going to plant suspicion in criminals' minds that it's like, is Telegram safe anymore? Because I know there are people that just don't believe any of the stuff. Like, I get tons of people that, I can show them Apple's privacy page and how they show stuff's encrypted. And they say, well, I don't believe that at all, which is like, well, why are you using Apple products then? And I know there's people that, I just got a comment recently about Google, like, don't put anything in, that you need private in a Google Doc.
Right.
And I'm like, well, there's Google's privacy policy here. They say they're not, And so it's like, people are still going to, if those people believe that they're being spied on by using these systems, then I got to think the actual criminals are also very concerned that when they organize things over a platform like Telegram, is like, is our stuff really safe? Can we trust that it really is encrypted? And when the CEO gets held by French authorities for a day or two and then says, no, nothing to worry about, they don't have any legal ground, are those criminals are still going to go and say, yeah, maybe we should move on just in case, move to some other system?
That's the thing, though. I mean, you're not stopping the criminal activity.
Yeah, but you are helping Telegram and you are helping the police. So, like, if the police in France are saying, we want to make it harder for criminals to communicate over an encrypted channel, Telegram makes it real easy. Let's bump them to the next platform, which is a little less used and a little harder to install and a little bit harder to use and less user-friendly and has more bugs. Let's push them onto that. And Telegram, in the meantime, is like, yes, please push them onto that. And so this helps everybody by just planting suspicion. And every time the U.S. government says, like, oh, we want a backdoor to Apple stuff, and Apple says, no way, does that take a few more people doing illegal stuff using Apple systems? And they say, just in case, let's move to something else. I don't know. That's just an idea I've got,
I get it. I do. The argument, though, applies to both good and negative uses, right? I mean, yes, you're pushing off the illegal use, but you're also making the legitimate users have to do the same thing if they're still concerned about that, right? If you're embedded in a dictatorship and you're trying to get a message out to the free world, you've got these same concerns about Telegram that the local government may be able to snoop on what you're doing.
Yeah.
And to be honest, there are multiple good alternatives. I think we've talked about this before, too, that there are so many messaging platforms, and that you and I specifically, as the techies of our circles, at least I tend to use whatever the person at the other end happens to use, because it's easier for me to understand and deal with multiple tools than it is for some of my friends. And what that means is I've got Telegram, I've got Signal, I've got WhatsApp, I've got Facebook Messenger, I've got all the tools installed, usually at least on my PC, if not also on my phone. But what that leads me to understand, though, is that there's a lot of tools. And there's a lot of good tools. In fact, there are those who will say that Signal, one of the ones I listed, is actually a better tool than Telegram. They trust Signal more. It's an open nonprofit organization rather than a for-profit guy from Russia, right? Mm-hmm. But it just means that, like you said, they're going to hop onto another platform, hopefully, assuming that they know that those platforms exist. I don't know. It just doesn't seem like it's solving the problem. And all it really is doing is causing a lot of FUD. And while I understand that these discussions are important to have and we need to understand where individual governments draw a line, it's still frustrating to see this kind of stuff happen.
It doesn't solve the problem for the legitimate users using it. It may actually solve problems for like the French government or French law enforcement. You know what I mean? It's like, because they don't care about the legit, you know, French law enforcement doesn't care about the political group in some other country trying to use Telegram to, you know, for their, you know, protest right. marches or whatever. Right. They don't care about that. That's not their concern. Their concern is these criminal groups. So it does, sowing any doubt in their mind helps the French law enforcement, maybe U.S. law enforcement from other countries and all of that. Maybe it doesn't help Telegram at all. Maybe it does, and it doesn't really help anyone else. But the people doing this is French law enforcement. So what helps them? Keeping criminals moving from platform to platform might help them. You know,
I don't get it. I don't see it, because I mean, yeah, they can make things harder for the criminals, but as we've seen, yeah. There's so many easy, simple solutions. There's even private stuff that they could be doing. That's the one thing that always gets me about calls to ban encryption or put back doors in encryption and that kind of stuff. Great. I'll just encrypt using something else that goes through this backdoored encryption channel. I mean, there's just so many different ways to solve the problem. Now, granted, there are dumb criminals out there, don't get me wrong, but those aren't the ones we're really talking about. The ones we're really talking about have some level of technical sophistication, and they're the ones that are going to say, oh, you're going to start screwing around with Telegram? Fine, I'll use something else. I'll use Signal. I'll use this. I'll use that. And all that will serve to do is to continue to hide their activity from the French authorities, and in fact, make it even harder for the French authorities to know where they've gone. Yeah, I don't know. It's a tough one. Ultimately, my take on it is that these tools that claim end-to-end encryption, they should actually be providing end-to-end encryption, which, as it turns out, Telegram doesn't do by default. You actually have to turn it on. But when they do provide end-to-end encryption, that should exist. If law enforcement wants to get themselves inserted into the conversation, they have opportunities like compromising the individual devices involved, which doesn't put everybody at risk. It only puts those people that they think are actually criminals at risk. The other one that I thought was hilarious, and this actually, I think it's been shut down, is that there was a very specific end-to-end encrypted messaging tool. It may have even been specific phones that criminals could buy for this specific purpose. And these things were highly thought of by the criminal folks, the criminal element. They were definitely handling, having their super secret private conversations on it. But what they didn't realize is that, I don't know, maybe a year or so after the phones and the technology became available, the FBI compromised it and inserted themselves in the middle and didn't tell anybody for like 2 or 3 years. So they were literally monitoring all the conversations all the time on this particular platform. And it's not one that you or I would recognize, and hopefully not one that we've ever used. But apparently it was one of those things where, the FBI got there in the middle. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I want to say that it's a good thing because they stopped some criminal activity. But if there was somebody using that particular tool for positive effects, then, they got listened into too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but that's what I'm saying. That's what could be happening here, is exactly that kind of thing could be happening. There could be this other platform that you and I don't even know about. And there's not enough for the criminals are moving over to it because they're on Telegram. and now, like they're seeing these headlines and saying, you know what, we've been meaning to move to this other platform. Meanwhile, the French law enforcement, people have compromised it.
Right.
And they're just like looking, it's like, well, we've got 50 different criminals on this platform. And hey, after we arrested this guy and sowed some doubt, now suddenly there's 500 of them on this platform. Big success for us, you know. I don't know.
I like it. Yes. Yeah. We're shutting down Telegram, but if you're interested, you should use this other tool.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So I just, like I said, that's an ongoing thing. Durov is currently still in prison or in jail or whatever it is. It'd be interesting to see if they end up charging him with something and how they met, you know, if they manage to have something to charge him with at all. They could easily be using this just as a way to force him to present them with more information that they would normally not get. But it's not going to be the messages per se. It's going to be the, you know, if anything, it's going to be all the reasons why he can't give them the message.
Yep. Cool. So I did we didn't do a show last week. And one of the reasons we didn't do a show was because I was away for a lot of the week. I went camping, summertime thing to do. And one of the things I did, one of the reasons I went camping, it's a strange reason, is I got a new camera and I really wanted to do something with it, you know, take it someplace where I could take some really good pictures. So this camera is kind of interesting. It's nothing special. I bought a Sony A7CR. And so th this is I my previous camera was a Canon T3i, which is an old camera at this point. But I bought that camera and thinking that, well, you know, I've seemed to buy a new camera every year because back years ago, digital cameras were changing really fast and stuff. And it almost seemed like every year there was like a new camera I wanted. So I bought a T3i and then I noticed I hadn't bought one in, I don't know, 12 years, 15 years, whenever the T3i came out. I just kept using the same camera. And I was like, oh, I guess we've reached kind of a plateau with cameras, or at least a slower plateau where things were ch not changing as fast. And I was still getting fantastic shots out of my Canon T3i and really enjoying it. But I thought, you know, it probably is time, especially because the iPhone cameras are getting so good that I'm having a hard time justifying pulling out my T3i when I'm actually getting more pixels out of my iPhone camera at this point. And sometimes better, some of the better like technology features for, you know, HDR and all sorts of stuff out of the iPhone. So I thought, I'm gonna get a camera and I wanna make sure I get something that's better than an iPhone camera and also something that will be in an ecosystem that will last so I can go another 12 or 15 years without buying a new camera. So I wanted to, I had actually purchased a Sony A6100 that I used for work to film my videos. And I really liked how the camera worked. But unfortunately, it needs to kind of sit on a tripod in my office and be used every day. So it wasn't the kind of thing where I could easily detach it and take it with me on trips and stuff. So I was like, all right, so I'll get a personal camera. And so the A7 line was like, is up from the A6000 line. And I really wanted to spend the money thinking I'm not going to get I might not get another camera the rest of my life. I don't know. So I bought this one. And it's basically, if you're familiar with the Sony line, it's there's an A7R, and R stands for resolution, so high resolution, which uses a full frame 60 megapixel sensor. And the C stands for compact. So they take away a few features that are much more professional user features of the camera to put the C there and make it a compact version of that. But it's the same sensor and uses the same lenses. So full frame, 60 megapixels, which is an incredible number of pixels to have in a photo.
It is. I had to look it up for folks listening. What that means is in terms of actual pixels. I actually asked ChatGPT. In 4x3, that's 10,000 pixels by 7,700 pixels.
Yeah, in reality, it's a little bit off from that. Let's see. In
Of course, it'll
reality,
be a little bit smaller than that, but still, that's a hell of a lot
yeah.
of pixels.
9,504 by 6,336. So a image that is like a landscape image that can be highly compressed. You're talking about, I think the smallest one I'm seeing here is like I see a landscape that's 12 megabytes and another landscape that has a variety of colors and different things in it that's 30 megs. That's like
That
the
would take
size.
like what? 20 floppy disks?
Yeah. Exactly, for the one photo, right? I mean, I remember when digital photography started, and there were certain scanners, like that, you could scan in something, and they would create this really big file that would be unwieldy and hard to deal with. And these are bigger than that. A raw photo taken with this. Let's see if I can look at here. I've got a raw. Here's a raw photo from this camera. 70 megs. So yeah, it's big. Now there's a couple of interesting things about this that I didn't really consider when I first started looking for a camera, because I'm not into like, oh, more megapixels is better, necessarily better. It's about like the light and the lenses, and then even a smaller amount, like an APS-C instead of a full frame sensor, the actual sensor pixels are larger, so they're taking in more light. So it's not like it's a one-to-one relationship. More pixels is better, because the bigger pixels on a camera with the bigger size of the pixel, because you have fewer pixels, means more light is captured by that pixel, which means that if you're looking at it, say, on your phone, like somebody looks at it on Instagram and sees it on their phone, there's not going to be any difference. Like, the quality is going to be the same, because it's the lens, the amount of light, and all of that, not how many pixels are down there. But what's interesting is that it turns the camera into kind of like this, basically a 4x zoom, really, or 2x, or depending. So I could take a picture with a fixed lens, no zoom on it at all, and I've got such a lens, and it's great for just. You just pull out your camera, you just take a picture. There's no framing it or zooming or whatever. If you want it to be closer, you have to move closer, right? But you take the picture, and you can then zoom in afterwards and still have a photo that is as high resolution as, say, one taken from a phone or one taken from a lesser camera. So you can like see a bird in a tree, for instance, and take a picture that includes way more than you normally would want. And then later on, you can crop to just the bird in the tree, and you still have something that's like 10 megapixels.
It's funny. I ran into exactly the same thing when I got, again, this is an older camera. I forget exactly how long ago I bought it, but I've got a Nikon D810, which is not a, it's a DSLR. It still does the flippy mirror thing. And it's a, what, 36 megapixel camera. And I had exactly that same reaction. It's like, great, this makes it so easy to quote unquote zoom by cropping.
Yeah. And it's weird, because when looking at a photo on my laptop, my MacBook Air, which is, it's a bigger screen. It's not a phone screen, it's a big screen. Looking at it on there, I'm used to seeing the photo on that screen, and then I'm basically seeing all the resolution there. Like, if I want to zoom in on a part of it, it's going to start to lose quality,
Oh,
right? But that's not the case with the 60 megapixel photos. And it has this weird feeling attached to it. It reminded me immediately of the old, the movies where they hit the enhance button. Look at that photo of, from a camera or whatever. Hit the enhance button and it
You're on
enhances
that
and
license,
suddenly,
yes.
yeah. And it has that weird feeling, because I am actually, when I'm looking at it on a big, fairly big screen, I'm still not seeing the level of detail that's there. And I can actually zoom in and be blown away. And like, say, okay, let me zoom in on, there's a tree and there's a bird, zoom in on the bird, and then be like, whoa, I could see like the reflection of the bird's eye and the feathers, the individual feathers. And I had none of that detail when I was looking at the entire photo. So it's really interesting. I'm also finding, of course, the photos take a little time to process. The things I'm used to being instant on the screen, even on my powerful computers, are no longer instant. Especially taking one of those raw photos and being like, oh, great, let me crop this, and having to like, hit the crop button, and then it taking 3 seconds to complete the operation.
Having to
And
manipulate a whole bunch of bytes.
yeah, exactly. And so actually, one of the things I can do with this camera that's interesting is I have lenses for that aforementioned Sony Alpha 6100, right, which is an APS-C sensor, smaller sensor. which means that the lens is actually built to focus all the light on a smaller area. So the lenses are shorter. So I've got like some what you would call pancake lenses for that. And it's still Sony E-mount lenses. So the mounting is the same on the new camera I've got. I could take that lens, put it on there, and it fits, but it's not an FE, full frame E-mount. It's an E, just for a smaller sensor. What happens is the camera automatically recognizes that and then only uses the middle rectangle of the sensor. So I turn the camera basically into a 26 megapixel camera when I put this lens on it.
Even so, that's a good pick. That's still a good
It's
camera.
still good. I still get all of the rest of the technology features of the camera when I'm doing that. And considering the fact that these 60 megapixel pictures are a bit of a pain to handle, I'm finding myself wishing that, like, okay, I've got this picture. It's a good picture. I don't know if I need to keep 60 megapixels around for the rest of my life of this picture. Like, I'll convert it to something less to take up less space because it's not that important of a picture that I need to have all that detail. And I'm thinking, well, I'm maybe okay with sometimes walking around with this camera with that other lens on it and only having the 26 megapixels because that lens literally is such a small pancake lens that it's shorter than the bump that comes out for you to hold the camera on the side on. So it literally adds no extra size to the camera. And which is nice. And I could actually, you can't slip it in your pants pocket. You can slip it in a jacket pocket though. So yeah, so that's another thing is like I've got two cameras here. I've got an APS-C camera if I put a certain lens on it, and I've got a full frame camera if I put a full frame lens on it. And I've got all the extra pixels for zooming in. So I don't necessarily need, I never walked around before with a fixed focus or fixed zoom lens, right?
A prime lens.
I've never, yeah, prime lens. I've never used a prime lens before very much. I've had them, but I always end up going with something that's got at least a little bit of a zoom just so I could frame things nicely. But now that I see that I have one prime lens, one full prime lens for this, and I will be using it, and I will be taking pictures that I do plan to crop later on down. It's a whole way, new way of actually, dealing with it. But I did actually take this very expensive camera with a very nice lens on this camping trip. And I got some great photos and some bad ones. But I did occasionally take my iPhone out and take a picture with that to compare, or just sometimes I just felt like, oh, this is an iPhone photo. And I'd say I took about 40 pictures with my iPhone. And about 150 pictures with the new camera. Out of the 150 pictures, 75 are good and 75 are bad. Out of the iPhone pictures, 40 out of 40 are good.
Oh,
And
interesting.
the
What
reason
defines
is,
bad?
well, the subject not being in focus was the main one.
Really?
Oh, there's a ground squirrel, it was in Rocky Mountain National Park. And if you think, oh, I took pictures of squirrels, how boring. Now, the squirrels in like Rocky Mountain National Park are like multicolored thing, that are like in pristine health and have been living in nature their whole lives. They're beautiful as compared to like the squirrel you see probably if you go to downtown Seattle, that
Or my
kind of,
backyard,
or your
yes.
backyard, scruffy urban squirrels, they're just gray. And I would end up with things out of focus because simply it would be a little too far away. And, oh, this tree looks interesting. Oh, thanks for putting that tree in focus. The squirrel I wanted in focus. Things like that. And some of it was the 60 megapixels was kind of to blame because I'm thinking it's like, yeah, this picture I took, there's a bird in a tree. If it was a 26 megapixel photo, it would be unusable anyway. The bird's too far away. At 60 megapixels, I could have cropped to the bird and made it usable, but you've focused on the tree branch instead because the
You
tree
have.
branch was in the center of the photo and it was closer and it was probably a little more interesting to the sensor. So I took bad photos, but I could have made every single one of them a good photo if I just knew how to use the camera better. It
I was
was
going to say,
first
don't you
time
have the
out.
option of setting
Yes, I have all that. And
costs?
once I get down to the point where I can switch between, like, I have some preset modes of the stuff I like, and bird in a tree or squirrel on a rock is like a preset I've got. I could go quickly and it would be a spot, autofocus in the middle, or, you could switch. I could say autofocus on animal or bird or lots of different things. But I just was not quick enough to get through those menus to set everything yet. So I ended up with 75 bad ones and 75 good ones, mostly because of stuff like that. I took, there was a moose that I got some good photos of, but half the photos I took of the moose were not good. The moose was so far away from me that it was hard to convince the camera to focus on the moose. And I eventually got it down. The moose hung around long enough for me to get things set up right so I
That's
could focus on the
nice.
moose. And I tried some manual focus ones too, which I was never able to get perfect because it was so far away. And I didn't know the right camera settings for being able to zoom in the viewfinder so I can focus better. So learning the new camera, this is why, I wanted to take it on a trip like this.
One of the things that I did with my Nikon, actually, I've got two Nikons, is something called back button focus. I don't know if there's an equivalent for the Sony, but rather than have it being continuous autofocus or autofocus when you push the shutter, you use a different button to focus and then you hit the shutter button. That changed my life in a way, in a sense that, focusing at least for things that weren't action shots. Right. If you've got something like just a squirrel sitting on a rock, it's very easy to separately then focus on the squirrel and then push the shutter. Which, like I said, it changed my life. It made a lot of things better. But it is something that is not the default setting. And like I said, I don't know if the Sonys have it. My little, I've got an older Sony ZV-1, and I don't think it has anything like that.
I think there's some similar things. I mean, this is the kind of their latest. I mean, this camera came out in May, which is another reason I wanted to get it, as I it's not a new no part of it is new in terms of, like, the A7 line's been around for a long time. The A7R, I think they're up to the A7R5. It's like, so that part of the technology is old. They've had A7Cs out for a while too. So this was a combining of lots of existing technologies into the latest camera, and it was compact, which is something I wanted. So I felt good, as because I know that in the past, and you could look at all the camera lines for all the different companies, and they're littered with lines of, like, this cool new camera they came out with. They came out with three versions of it over 2 years, and then they dropped it, and now it's like, you can only buy that line used. And it was nice to buy one where I know this has ancestry in the line, and the line's probably going to go on for quite a while. But yet I'm not buying the 2022 model or 2021 model. I'm buying the 2024 model, and hopefully I'll be using this to 2040.
You're causing me some serious camera lust. It's like I said, the two Nikons I've got are both DSLRs, and emphasis on the R, right? The reflex part of it. And the Nikon has had their mirrorless cameras out for a while now, and I have a hard time justifying the cost, but I want to play with those. They're so much fun.
And of course, the thing I'm glad I brought a standard kind of mid-range zoom lens that gave me a really wide angle and allowed me to zoom in a little bit. It was at 20 to 70, for those that know.
I did the same thing with my Nikon. I have a prime. I think I've used it twice. I go back to that zoom every single time. It is just so much more flexible.
It is, except that not enough, because, like, this moose, if I had my Canon with me, that had a something to 300. I would have gotten such a nice picture of that moose
I actually
with.
have two zooms for this one. The standard one, which basically does a little bit of a slightly wide angle to slightly zoomed in, right? But then I also have a dedicated zoom. The only problem is, as with all of these interchangeable cameras, is like, oh, I see a moose. By the time you change your lens, it's gone.
Exactly. And I am going to get, I mean, I know I'm going to get a telephoto lens for it. I just decided, no, hold off. You got this good versatile one, and you've got a street photography prime lens. Use those for a while, and then next year, maybe next year, I'll get a zoom lens, but or a telephoto lens. But then, at least I got a decent photo. Last time I saw a moose when I was hiking, all I had with was my iPhone, and I'm thinking I was around maybe an iPhone, I don't know, 7 or something like that. So all I got was basically a very pixelated moose when I zoomed in, enough to prove that, hey, I saw a moose while I was hiking, but it doesn't make a very good photo. So at least now with the 60 megapixels, I've got something that looks like a moose.
Pix or it didn't happen. Yes. Very cool.
Yeah.
So let's grump for a minute, shall we?
Yes.
So, my get off my lawn topic is Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. Bill Gates does not make me grumpy. It's funny. I have, sent email to him 3 times, received one reply, spoken to him once, and I think I've been to his house like 5 times for various, events. The interesting thing is that everybody, and I do mean everybody, keeps blaming Bill personally
Ah.
for the most recent thing that they don't like in Windows.
Yeah.
Absolutely convinced that it is Bill behind that feature decision, or it's Bill behind that marketing strategy, or it's Bill that, is out to get them personally in some cases. It's just silly. Bill hasn't been involved with the company since 2008, so we're up to 16 years now that he's not actively been in the company, and even then, he wasn't making feature level decisions. That
Yeah.
would have been a colossal waste of his time. He might definitely have reviewed feature level decisions, but think about it. 16 years ago, what version of Windows were we talking about?
Yeah.
Probably XP at best. So my grump is not with Bill Gates. My grump is with everyone who continues to blame him personally for today's problems.
Yep. And my grump is kind of the opposite. It's still just as grumpy about it, but it's kind of the opposite. It's Steve Jobs, right? And in the opposite way, first of all, nobody could blame Steve Jobs for anything going on at Apple now because he's dead. So it's the opposite thing. Everybody blames him not being there
Ah, I see what you mean.
for the reason, like so common, somebody doesn't like a feature on any Apple device. And the common thing to say is, this wouldn't have happened if Steve Jobs were still alive. And that, of course, is almost certainly not true. And people have the rose-colored glasses view of things. There were plenty of things that were, feature problems and issues and all sorts of stuff. Early days of Apple, when Steve Jobs was in charge, last 10 years of Steve Jobs' life, when he was in charge of Apple and made all these decisions, there were plenty of things that either slipped through because Steve Jobs wasn't making feature level decisions. Although famously, sometimes Steve Jobs did make feature level decisions. And sometimes some of those things were actually Steve Jobs's fault. So kind of the opposite thing there too. But there are certainly times when people will say, oh, this feature or this bug wouldn't be present if Steve Jobs were still around. And my thought is, oh, I can think of specific things that happened while Steve Jobs was in charge that not only got through that were like this, but I believe he was involved or he did actually force the engineers to actually do this specific thing.
That's funny.
So yeah, it really it's funny how often that happens. And yeah, there were tons of, people do tend to actually look at older versions of Mac OS and say, oh, back in, back things have gone downhill since Mac OS Snow Leopard, or something like that. I'm like, really? All these new features that have been added that, you would miss if suddenly you were forced to go back to Snow Leopard,
And of course, people claim up and down, no, that's not the case. I'd be perfectly happy with this 20-year-old version or 15-year-old version of the
Sure.
operating system. I hear it
Yeah, but
all.
so Yeah, one person will complain, oh, why isn't there ability to highlight inside of notes? And then say, something like, oh, back in the days we didn't have problems like this. It's like those days there wasn't a notes app. You weren't complaining about highlighting in notes because there was no notes. It was you were making notes in a in text editor. I don't know what you were doing, but there certainly was no highlighting there. So anyway, yeah, it's kind of the opposite thing. Bill Gates gets blamed because he's still alive and people don't realize he doesn't do things. And the absence of Steve Jobs gets blamed because people don't realize that he wasn't perfect back then. Nobody is. And there were plenty of mistakes then too, and there would probably be still be mistakes even if he were alive and still in charge of Apple.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it, like I said, it's one of those things that I see too frequently.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
Yep.
on the ain't it cool front, I noticed both of our choices are on Apple TV, which is great. The show that we are currently watching is called Slow Horses. It is actually. Its fourth season is going to release, I think, next week. We just found it and started on the first season. It is a British cop show, which surprises me that it's on Apple TV Plus, just because I usually find the British stuff over on Amazon Prime or on Acorn or those kinds of things. But it is essentially a classic case of, these are. MI5 misfits. They've had screw ups in their career and they've been basically relegated to this one. I don't even want to call it a division, but a group where their job is to do nothing. It's almost a punishment for whatever, infractions they've had in the past. And of course, someone gets added to that group and it turns out that he can't sit with that. He's got to be able to do things. And I won't say hilarity ensues because, my last episode, there was a beheading, but it is a very interesting show. It started a little bit slow. It's got Gary Oldman in it, a couple of other well-known actors that you would recognize. And we're actually, it's growing on us. We're actually, enjoying it quite a bit. So anyway, that's Slow Horses on Apple TV.
Yeah, and the only new show I've started in the last 2 weeks has been Bad Monkey, which is also on Apple TV Plus, and it's kind of a cop mystery show too. It has a bit of a retro vibe to it. Not that it's retro at all. It takes place today, and it just has this feeling. It's down and takes place in the Florida Keys, and Vince Vaughn is the star, and he basically plays his typical role. It's his typical talking style and acting style. But it kind of does, it feels like the kind of show where it could have been made, decades ago. There's a mystery, multi-level mystery thing going on. And he's a cop that is gets in trouble a lot, and he's trying to solve this unusual case that has kind of come up that nobody else seems to want solved.
Right.
And he
He's
just
suspended
keeps
at the
bugging him.
beginning, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, he's
Because.
suspended at the beginning, and the case isn't even a case.
Right.
I mean, he's basically given the task of like getting rid of a piece of evidence that is not even like nobody thinks is actually going to lead anywhere. So just clean this up. And then he wants to. He doesn't want to actually get involved. But then he's like, ugh. And then, yeah, it's kind of that reluctance that's interesting because typically in a story like this, the cop or the detective is the one that's like, no, there's something here. Like, why won't people listen to me? He seems like he really just would rather this thing go away. And then something keeps bugging him. So then he takes another step
Well, crap, I guess I better look at this too. Yeah.
yeah, I just can't let it go and stuff. So anyway, that seems it seems entertaining so far. Enjoying it.
Yep. Like I said, we're watching it as well and enjoying it too.
Oh, good.
So, self-promotion in theme with my complaint about Bill.
Yes.
The article that I'm pointing folks at this week is Why Didn't Microsoft Fix This Horrible Bug? AskLeo.com/4927. And it is not about a bug. The first time this actually got published, everybody said, well, what's the bug you're talking about? Tell me about the bug you're talking about. There is no specific bug. This is an example of how people get all wrapped around the axle when something they think is absolutely critical doesn't get fixed for years. And I explain a little bit about why that might be. And the complexities of software development and priorities and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's an interesting read to understand why, like I said, the bug that you might think is the most important bug ever may never get fixed.
The video I'm going to point to is actually a slightly different one for me, and it's getting an interesting reaction. It's called Extreme Mac Productivity Ideas. And I didn't even think of it when I titled the video, but somebody commented on it that it was the first YouTube video that they saw that used the word extreme in the title, and it wasn't clickbait. It's because I didn't intend it as clickbait. I intended it as a warning because I had a list of productivity ideas. Every time I do a productivity video, I'd have ideas I dismiss because I'd be like, that's kind of a crazy idea. I don't even want to suggest it. And this list kept growing until I did this video that includes all of them. So to give you an idea, like one of them is automatically archiving your email. So you could set your email up so that after you don't read an email for say 3 days, it automatically leaves your inbox. So you better check your email, and keep that inbox clean, else you're going to miss stuff. There's even other things you can do like that happen kind of automatically. You could have Safari tabs close automatically. A lot of people have the problem where they have like 50 tabs open. You can set them to close after 1 day or a
Well,
week.
but the people with 50 tabs open, I mean, they want them open for years.
But so my suggestion is it's extreme. If you have this problem, set them to automatically close. And the word extreme is meant as a warning, saying these are really extreme ideas. Like other things are take away your keyboard. If you find you're not good at using your mouse or trackpad, take away your keyboard if you rely on keyboard shortcuts too much. Force yourself to use your mouse or trackpad and see how far you can get with it. Or the opposite, kind of take your mouse or trackpad away, force yourself to try to navigate with only keyboard shortcuts. And that's a way to finally get some keyboard shortcuts in common use by yourself.
In your muscle memory.
Muscle memory, even I one that I know our friend Randy would like is switch to a Dvorak keyboard. That's pretty extreme, but that again, the warning there, these are extreme. And another one that I'm getting the most reaction to isn't even a Mac thing. It's time tracking. The idea is you put a piece of paper down next to you and you start work. Say you start at 9 o'clock. You write 9 o'clock checking email and you check your email. And when your email's done, you're done checking email, you write 9:15 done. And then 9:15 working on this or whatever. And you do that every time you switch tasks. And the idea is number one, you gain an understanding of where you're spending your time. And number two, it makes you reluctant to switch tasks. If you just switched from email to working on editing video and you see a notification that an email comes in, it's like, oh, in order to read that email, I need to stop this task, put a time down, put another time down, say email, and then, do that. So I won't switch, which is an interesting way to build a habit. And then the idea is you don't do it permanently, you do it for a few days, a few weeks, see how it can make you more productive, and then you leave it behind, maybe to revisit it later on to even, go to the next step.
I like
Anyway, I've got 20 different tips in there for extreme productivity tips like that. So that's the video I'll link to.
Well, I will have to go to my note now and say at whatever time this is, finished recording, because we're at the
Yes.
end of another one. We've put in over an hour once again. As always, I think that wraps us up for this week. As always, thank you everyone for listening. As it turns out, I was looking at the stats the other day, and we like to joke about there being a listener. But actually, there's more of you out there than we realized. So thank you again for, spending an hour with us and listening to us ramble.
Yep.
Thanks again for listening, and we will see you again real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at thpodcast.com/TEH229. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.